to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. As a people, we are inseparably linked to, indeed we're often defined as a nation of, mass consumption. But what does that mean exactly? And when did mass consumption become part of the American economy and culture? That's the subject of this week's interview with Lisbeth Cohen. And after that, David Greenberg examines the widely held belief that the United States has never started a war. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on March 13, 1868, the impeachment trial of President Andrew Johnson began. Johnson, a U.S. Senator from Tennessee, remained loyal to the Union at the outbreak of the Civil War, becoming the only senator from a seceding state to do so. President Lincoln rewarded Johnson by appointing him military governor of Tennessee in 1862. 2 years later, he was elected vice president. Following Lincoln's assassination in 1865, Andrew Johnson became president. Like Lincoln, he proposed a lenient policy toward the conquered South, but his plan was far less radical than that insisted upon by the Congress, and a political struggle ensued. In March 1867, Congress defied Johnson by passing the Tenure of Office Act over his veto. The act was intended to prevent Johnson from replacing cabinet members and other government appointees who sided with Congress. When, in February 1868, Johnson fired Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton, the House of Representatives voted 11 articles of impeachment, and on March 13th his trial in the Senate began. 2 months later, 35 senators found him guilty as charged, just one vote short of the two-thirds majority required to remove him from office. Johnson survived, but he was not reelected to the presidency later that year.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, one of the longest texts in the ancient Maya language has been discovered in Guatemala, and it's changing a long-standing interpretation of that people's history. It provides evidence that a century-long superpower war sowed the seeds of their downfall. The Maya were among the great pre-Columbian civilizations of the New World, dominating Mesoamerica for more than 1,000 years until they began a rapid and still mysterious decline around 800 A.D. For years, historians thought that the War of Dos Pilas against the great city-state of Tikal was a regional power struggle between ruling brothers. The newly discovered text, actually inscribed on stone stairs, tells a different story. It suggests that the war resulted in widespread death and destruction. Tikal triumphed, but the prolonged struggle so debilitated both sides that neither was able to regain its dominance. It was like the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, one scholar commented. Regional wars became more numerous, and in 800 it all unraveled. The Maya began to abandon its cities, and the civilization went into decline. This is Talking History. In the wake of World War II, the United States entered an age of unprecedented prosperity and consumption. Indeed, mass consumption became one of the most significant factors in the nation's recent history, and the subject of a book by our guest this week, Lisbeth Cohen. Professor Cohen is interviewed by Jim Madison, professor of history at Indiana University.
With the end of World War II came a period of unprecedented prosperity for America. By the 1950s, Americans seemed to be a people of plenty, living in an age of affluence, with the promise of more equality and democracy for all through consumption. But perhaps it wasn't so simple. Our guest today is Lisbeth Cohen, the Howard Mumford Jones Professor of American Studies in the Department of History at Harvard University. Professor Cohen is the author of a new book titled A Consumer's Republic, The Politics of Mass Consumption in Postwar America, published by Knopp. Welcome, Liz.
Thank you.
Let's start with this thing called mass consumption as it developed in the 1950s? What was it? Explain it to us.
Okay, well, we all know what it is in that we're consumers every day of our lives, but mass consumption has a history, and it has a history that actually goes back before the post-war period. In fact, goods produced for a mass market can be traced all the way back to the 18th and 19th century, British pottery and dishes and so forth, American-produced goods. So Americans have been buying mass-produced goods for a long time, but I think there are very important changes in mass consumption in the 20th century. First of all, there are more of them, and the automobile is probably the key here in the early 20th century. Ford's notion that everyone should be able to afford a car is revolutionary. But when we move to the post-war period, not only are there more and more goods available to people, more packaged goods, more mass-produced goods, you don't have clothing made by a seamstress, you buy it mass-produced. You don't get groceries out of a barrel, you buy it packaged in the grocery store and so forth. But more than that even is the importance, I think, of mass consumption to the American economy in the post-war period. And so when America comes out of World War II, having just been through 15 years of crisis, 10 years of a Great Depression, and then a number of years of war, there's tremendous fear about what's going to happen. Will we go back to being in depression? And mass consumption, fueling a mass consumption market, getting Americans to buy as a way of really helping the society and the economy prosper becomes the solution.
But you suggest it also has something to do, consuming has something to do with civic responsibility as well.
Yeah, and that's why I've coined this term. It's my term, not a word that anybody used at the time. What I call it a consumer's republic. And the idea is that not only were Americans encouraged to buy to satisfy their own pent-up needs and desires. They too had been through a decade of depression and then 5 years of World War. But it was also promoted as a way of helping the nation, that when you bought, you didn't just indulge yourself, you helped all of Americans and you helped America prosper.
Right. A lot of this prosperity, a lot of this good life in the 50s happens in the suburbs, and you have some wonderful insights into suburban living and the creation of suburbs. But there's also not all happiness in the suburbs. There's not all equality and justice and goodness in the suburbs in your version.
Yeah, okay. Well, that may be one of the more controversial arguments in the book. But I do see both sides to suburban life. And it's really based in this larger argument I'm making that it was in private mass markets that America was to prosper in the post-war period. And then the sort of centerpiece of this mass consumption economy was the private real estate market and the building of private homes for everybody, mass suburbia, I call it. And what this meant, of course, is that people who had been renters before, who had been perfectly satisfied to live in cities, now were expected and came to desire to solve their housing problems, because many, many Americans had them after the war, by buying a home on the private market. But that came with many complications. A home became the greatest sort of asset that many Americans had. They invested their life savings in it. And they increasingly became concerned that that was a good investment. And so what we see over time is that suburbs that originally may have been mixed by class, never really by race, over time became more and more sort of segmented. So that, for example, there were sociologists who studied the social makeup of Levittown, Long Island, the kind of quintessential American suburb. And in 1950, they found a fair amount of cross-class presence. There were people who were foremen in factories living next door to teachers, living next door to lawyers and so forth. By 1960, when they came back again, it was really a lower middle class community, and the professionals had moved on to more upper class suburbs down the highway. And so what I argue happens as these communities become more and more sort of segmented or pitched at a certain place in the the sort of hierarchy of real estate values, is that they not only are more and more homogeneous, but they can afford a different quality of services. And because in the United States we fund many local services, and most particularly schools, the greatest vehicle for upward mobility probably in the post-war period, by locality, that segmentation had great implications for the resources that Americans had at their disposal. So we get one community with, homes of a very high value with a tax revenue that's property tax revenue that's quite high. That community can afford good schools with small class sizes and so forth, good facility, good plant. And then you have a community that the sort of cops and firemen suburbs, the more working class suburbs, where that's not the case. And then you have American children who don't have access to the same advantages. So I suggest that along with this sort of improvement in the housing stock for many Americans came new kinds of hierarchies and inequalities.
What about race in these suburbs? Are there African Americans in Levittown? Are there blacks in the suburbs of America?
Race was probably the sort of the strongest boundary in this post-war mass suburbanization process. While there were working class suburbs and there were lower and middle class people living together in some suburbs, it was very rare for African Americans to find a place for themselves in the sort of typical post-war suburb. And what was happening was that blacks were increasingly coming up from the South. This is the second great migration, settling in cities. Whites were leaving cities. And so over the post-war period, we actually find a tremendous racial segmentation in metropolitan areas. I did a little case study in the book of Essex County, New Jersey, which is the county that Newark sits in. And while 30% of the population of Essex County was black, almost all of that population was in Newark. Only 13% was living outside of Newark, and those blacks were living only in three communities. All the other towns in Essex County had minuscule African-American populations.
Right. One of the standard features of suburban life that we all know is the shopping center. And you have a lot of interesting things to say about the shopping center as the cathedral of consumption, perhaps. As a place, especially interesting to me, as a place you argue that was built for women, especially in the early versions of the shopping centers. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I have two chapters, one on this issue of residence and suburban living, and the other chapter, the one that sort of is its pair, is about the shopping center as the new public place in suburbia. Many of these suburban communities were carved out of farmland. They were cabbage and carrot fields, and there were no cities and towns there. There were some old market towns nearby, or there was the major metropole not so far away. But pretty soon, developers and retailers realized that there's a new market there to reach. These people who are now settling, buying houses at some distance from the city, and they go after it. And the regional shopping center is the result. It takes some time, but by the late 1950s, regional shopping centers are emerging all over the country. And I argue that this is a pretty interesting and important new public space. It is legally privately owned, and that is a very important distinction from the kind of city that we're used to.
And or the town square.
Or the town, exactly. Yeah. And it turns out, after many court battles and tests and so forth, that shopping center owners have some authority over the use of that public space that they wouldn't have were they store owners on that town square or downtown and so forth. And so that's an important issue that I investigate. But back to your question about women, I argue that there's a kind of interesting paradox in the relationship of women to shopping centers. On the one hand, as you say, these were public spaces designed for them. After all, in the 50s, many men were returning to the cities to work. Many women were home in the suburbs. Shopping was something that, you know, it was expected and hoped they would do. And so in the design, many architects and designers were very aware of this new female customer.
How specifically did they respond to that customer?
Well, one funny thing is that they designed parking spaces extra large, extra wide for the new female drivers of the post-war period. Because remember, when Americans were mostly living in cities, many of them didn't have cars, many didn't drive, and certainly many women didn't drive. And so one of the first things you had to learn when you moved to the suburbs was how to drive. So that was one thing. There also were special programs for women, child care for children so women could buy. But that's the one side, the fact that the suggestion that this space was really intended for women. On the other hand, I think there were ways that the new shopping center limited the sort of influence and authority of women, and I investigate that. For example, many of these shopping centers were really promoted as a way to shop and buy and build and sort of use credit in your purchasing. Mm. Now, as credit became a bigger and bigger thing in the post-war period, it became one of the building blocks of the Consumers' Republic. Women were very limited in their access to credit until the 1970s. So, yes, they may have shopped, but they were increasingly dependent on their husbands.
Including married women.
Absolutely.
Yes.
In fact, married women, widowed women, only single women could get a charge card, for example, in their own names. So that was one aspect. Another was that men, as consumption became more and more central to the post-war economy, men gained more authority over it. Women for, you know, most of the century had been viewed as the main consumers. But in the post-war period, you start to see men being brought in to the equation, and many storekeepers pitching their sales to husbands. Shopping centers were open many longer hours than downtown stores. Weekends were the big time for purchasing. And so women lost a certain kind of authority over that purchasing. They have orchestrated the family's buying, but they didn't really control it. And then as part of that, I also would want to mention that many of these suburban department stores saw women, suburban women, as their workforce. They were in the process of fighting unionization in many of their downtown department stores, and they saw this ready-made labor force of suburban women who might want to work part-time to make a little extra money, get out of the house, and so forth, and they went for it.
Right.
The result was, though, that they hired these women at minimum wages, no benefits. Often the big benefit was a discount on what you bought, and even a bigger discount if you wore it while you were on the shop floor. So that I argue that the shopping center was kind of a mixed bag for women.
Right.
It was built with them in mind, and yet it constrained them as much as it liberated them.
Just one last question here, Liz. Is there in all of this American consumption in this period of prosperity, are there things that are unique about America, or is it now a global kind of thing?
That's a good question, and it's a contemporary question, and not one that, as an historian, I may be all that well placed to answer. It's something that, you know, your listeners should think about as well. But what I would say is that I think that the United States really promoted the notion of the Consumers' Republic, the concept of it, abroad in the post-war period. When we reconstructed Japan, when we reconstructed Western Europe, that was the formula that we tried to...
The image of what was good,
exactly,
about America.
That, you know, we wanted to build markets in Japan and in Western Europe for American goods as well as for indigenously produced goods as well. If anybody who's visited Eastern Europe after 1989 knows that, you know, that the Consumers' Republic is alive and well, and yet I guess what I would want to say is that we should learn something from the American case, that while the Consumers' Republic may bring goods, it also can bring inequalities.
Yes, and you have a lot to say about inequalities as a consequence of this fascination with consumption. We've been talking with Elizabeth Cohen, the Howard Mumford Jones Professor of History at Harvard University and the author of a new book, A Consumer's Republic, The Politics of Mass Consumption in Postwar America. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
For our site of the week, in which we call to your attention resources, real and virtual, of interest to historians of all ranks, We've chosen a virtual site that allows you to, as the name of the site suggests, do history. Here to tell you about it is Jane Kaminsky, professor of history at Brandeis University and co-editor of the online magazine Commonplace.
Imagine a Home Depot for historians. After browsing aisles piled with raw materials and receiving expert advice, could the do-it-yourselfer craft an elegant book or a compelling documentary? Yes, answers Do History, a superb online resource from the Film Study Center at Harvard University. This site invites visitors to explore the process of piecing together the lives of ordinary people, in this case of the 18th century Maine midwife Martha Ballard. Do History is both a teaching tool and an archive. The site presents a wealth of documents historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich used to uncover Ballard's story, including the now legendary diary that Ballard kept between 1785 and 1812.
February 2nd. Snowed. I was called to see Black Kitty. She was delivered of a son before I arrived. Sally Cox gave me a snuffbox.
Here in original handwriting and in searchable text is the entirety of Ballard's personal record, nearly 10,000 individual entries. You can turn the diary's pages or jump to a specific date. But what to make of this wealth of raw data? Do History provides innovative building plans. Click on Decoding the Diary and learn to demystify Ballard's record-keeping, or examine related entries and stories and themes from the diary. A section entitled Doing History brings these skills together in two interactive case studies, allowing the user to investigate and document themes and events. Finally, a history toolkit offers well-written lessons, such as what to do with a diary and how to read probate records. Do History is an innovative resource that will delight users. This website may be found at www.dohistory.org.
You've been listening to Jane Kaminsky, professor of history at Brandeis University and co-editor of the online magazine Commonplace. This week's Site of the Week was produced by Kelly Schrum of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. And finally, for our commentary of the week, we examine the widely held belief that the United States does not start wars. It's a point commonly made in the arguments of those who oppose our proposed preemptive strike policy against those who are believed to pose a threat to the nation. But is it historically correct? Historian David Greenberg takes a look.
One of the main reasons that many people oppose the invasion of Iraq is that the United States clearly intends to start a war, and they feel that such a naked act of belligerence violates this nation's peace-loving history. America, we like to think, doesn't start wars. In considering the nation's so-called good wars, American self-congratulation seems justified. The Revolution was provoked by the British Army's march upon a cache of colonists' arms in Concord. In the Civil War, Confederate rebels fired upon Federal ships at Fort Sumter. And no one would claim that after Pearl Harbor, the United States lacked cause in declaring war on Japan. These examples, and some of the lesser wars, suggest that the pending Iraq attack violates our traditions. But the United States has also sent its troops abroad for dubious reasons, sometimes reasons far less compelling than those being voiced today. The Mexican War of 1846 grew from a desire for conquest. President James Polk sent troops into a disputed Texas-Mexico border area to provoke an attack, and Congress didn't even wait for the attack before declaring war. Ultimately, the U.S. wrested from Mexico what is now the American Southwest. Then there's the Spanish-American War. In 1895, when Cubans rose up against their Spanish colonizers, many Americans favored helping to drive Spain out. But it took the 1898 explosion of an American ship, the Maine, in Havana Harbor, to bring the United States into combat. The blast was probably caused by technical problems on the ship. But the public demanded war, and the U.S. invaded not just Cuba, but also the Philippines, assuming imperial burdens. Unlike the good wars, the Spanish and Mexican conflicts are scarcely remembered today. The eventual realization that in each case the supposed cause of war was in fact bogus brought shame upon the U.S. and bolstered those who attacked it as imperialist. Even more hurtful in the world's eyes were the wars of westward expansion against American Indians. and the dozens of regime changes in Latin America waged in the name of the Monroe Doctrine. Yet America also has a tradition of waging war for noble reasons, for which it has justly gained the affection of other nations. FDR and Woodrow Wilson were beloved around the world. What does all this tell us? In debating war with Iraq, we should address not only whether we go to war, but also why. If we invade, we should do so not because we deem it justifiable, but because we can prove that it is just.
You've been listening to David Greenberg, a visiting scholar at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Greenberg is the author of Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. As always, we welcome your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. And we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. You can learn more about the OAH and Talking History at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Be sure to join us again next week for the first of a two-part series with our guest, Professor James Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, and Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians.